On our return to Isiolo, we were thrilled to hear that a call from London was booked for the next morning. To speak to someone in England, 4,000 miles away over the telephone, is very exciting when one is in a remote outpost. Now we heard our publisher, Billy Collins, accepting our invitation to come out and meet Elsa. We chartered a plane to bring him from Nairobi to the nearest place at which an aeroplane can land, and then 2 days beforehand, we set off. We were determined to find Elsa and try to keep her and the cubs near to the camp so that she should be there to meet her publisher. We arrived in camp early. George fired a shot to notify Elsa of the fact, and soon we heard her, but she did not turn up. As her voice came from the direction of the studio, I went to it and saw her and the cubs by the river drinking. She glanced at me and went on lapping, as though she were not in the least surprised to see me after 8 days' absence. During the evening, we heard Elsa's mate calling, and around midnight, George woke up to find her sitting on his bed and licking him, while the cubs sat outside the tent watching her. Next morning I went with Ibrahim to meet Billy Collins. At lunchtime we arrived in the little Somali village, where we expected the aeroplane to land, and I told the Africans to keep the airstrip free of livestock, as a plane might arrive at any moment. The airfield was originally made for locust control. Only a few bushes needed to be cleared to bring it into existence. It is now seldom used, and as the local herds often cross it, blends so well into the surroundings that it is difficult to find from the air. About tea time, we heard the vibrations of an engine, but it was a long time before the circling aircraft landed. Then the airstrip was suddenly covered by the entire village population. The colourful turbaned Mohammedans, clad in loose falling garments, watched Billy Collins and the pilot clamber out from the small cabin. Billy had only arrived 3 hours earlier at Nairobi, after a night flight in a Comet. I thought it very sporting of him to venture immediately afterwards, on this rather different flight, in a four-seater, bumping through notorious air pockets, round the massive Mount Kenya, and searching for the small airstrip in the vast sandy plains of the northern frontier. Expecting Billy to be tired after his long flight from London, and also feeling not too happy about the possibility of meeting elephants in the dark, I suggested camping there for the night. But after a discussion with Ibrahim and the game scout, we decided to drive on. When we reached the outpost where Elsa's goat deposit is stationed, the man in charge gave me a note for George, asking urgently for his presence next day at the nearest administration post as witness in a game case. After 2 more hours of brushing and winding our car through thick bush, we arrived at camp, ready for a reviving drink. But before George had time to pour it out, we heard the familiar hm, and a few moments later, Elsa came rushing along, followed by her cubs. She welcomed us in her usual friendly manner, and after a few cautious sniffs also rubbed her head against Billy, while the cubs watched from a short distance. Then she took the meat and dragged it out of the lamplight into the dark near my tent, where she settled with her children for their meal. While this went on, we had our supper. We'd made a special thorn enclosure next to George's tent for Billy's tent, and after introducing him to his home, barricaded his wicker gate from outside with thorns and left him to a well-deserved night's sleep. Elsa remained outside my tent enclosure, and I heard her softly talking to her cubs until I fell asleep. At dawn, I was woken by noises from Billy's tent and recognized his voice and George's. Evidently, they were trying to persuade Elsa to leave Billy's bed. As soon as it got light, she had squeezed herself through the densely woven wicker gate and hopped onto Billy's bed, caressing him affectionately through the torn mosquito net and holding him prisoner under her heavy body. Billy kept admirably calm, considering that it was his first experience of waking up with a fully grown lioness resting on him. Even when Elsa nibbled him slightly in his arm, her way of showing her affection, he did nothing but talk quietly to her. Soon she lost interest and followed George out of the enclosure, where she romped round the tents with her cubs. Afterwards, the family disappeared towards the big rock, and later George left to attend the court. When he returned at tea time, he told us that he had just passed a herd of elephant close to camp, so we finished our tea quickly and drove along the track to film them. But when we came to the big rock, we noticed Elsa on its top posing magnificently against the sky. We forgot about the elephants and walked to the base of the rock, hoping to film Elsa and our cubs. But Elsa kept aloof, and the cubs did not appear. We waited for a considerable time, but as nothing happened, we decided to try our luck with the elephants. As soon as we had returned to the car, Elsa stood up and called her cubs. As if to tease us, all of them now posed splendidly. However, as Elsa had made it so clear that she was in no mood to be filmed, we drove on to the spot where George had met the elephants, but we found nothing but their footmarks, and we returned to Elsa. By the time we reached the rock, the light was too weak for photographing, so we just watched the family through our field glasses while Elsa kept her eyes fixed on us. Finally, we called her and she came down at once, and after greeting us all affectionately, landed with a heavy thud on the roof of the Land Rover. While we patted her paws, which dangled over the windscreen, she watched the cubs, which were still playing on the rock. They finally scrambled down, then she jumped off the car and disappeared into the bush to meet them. We took this opportunity to drive home and prepare a carcass for the family. As soon as it was ready, they arrived and began to tear at the meat, while we had our sundowners a few feet away. All that evening, we watched the lions, who seemed to have accepted Billy as a friend. Before daybreak, I was again woken up by noises coming from his tent, into which Elsa had once more found her way to say good morning. After some coaxing from George, who had come to his rescue, she left. George then reinforced the thorns outside the wicker gate with such a bulk that he felt sure Elsa would not be able to penetrate this barricade, so he went to bed again. But Elsa was not going to be defeated by a few thorns, and so after a short time, Billy found himself again being embraced by her and squashed under her weight. While he struggled to free himself from the entangling mosquito net, George came to his rescue, but this time he took much longer to remove the thorns outside the gate, and by the time he got inside, Elsa had managed to clasp her paws around Billy's neck and held his cheekbones between her teeth. We'd often watched her doing this to her cubs. It was a sign of affection, but the effect on Billy must have been very different. I was very much alarmed at Elsa's unusual behaviour. She'd never done anything like this to a visitor, and I could only interpret it as a sign of affection. If she had not done it in play, she would have acted in a very different way. In spite of my remaining with Billy, she forced herself a third time through the wicker gate before either George, who was outside, or I, who was inside, could stop her. Billy was standing up this time, and being tall and strong, braced himself against Elsa's weight when she stood on her hind legs, resting her front paws on his shoulders and nibbled at his ear. As soon as she released him, I gave her such a beating that she sulkily left the tent, and in a rather embarrassed way spent her affection on Jesper, rolling with him in the grass, biting and clasping him exactly as she'd done Billy. Finally, the whole family gambled off towards the rocks. I do not know who was more shaken, poor Billy or myself. All we could think was that this extraordinary reaction of Elsa to Billy was her way of accepting him into the family, for only to her cubs and to us had she ever shown affection in this way. But we did not want to risk a repetition of her demonstrations towards our friend, so we decided to break his visit short and leave camp immediately after breakfast. At the beginning of June, after 10 days' absence, we returned to camp, and just before sunset reached a place about 6 miles short of it. We saw that every tree and bush was loaded with birds of prey and drove slowly towards them. Then suddenly we found ourselves surrounded by elephants who had closed in on us from every direction. It must have been the herd, numbering some 30 or 40 head, which had been in the neighbourhood for the past weeks. George at once jumped onto the roof of the Land Rover and stood there, rifle in hand. We waited for what seemed an endless time, Then some of the elephants started to cross the car track about 20 yards from us. It was a magnificent sight. They moved in single file, jerking their heads disapprovingly in our direction. To protect their young, they kept them closely wedged between their bulky bodies. After making protests, most of the herd moved away, leaving small groups still undecided in the bush. We waited for them to follow, and eventually all but two went off. George wanted to see the kill which had attracted the birds, and since the light was failing, he decided to walk with Makede between the two remaining groups of elephant. Meanwhile, Ibrahim and I stood on the roof of the car and kept a close watch on the beasts so that we could warn George of their movements. He found a freshly killed water buck and lion spore around it. Very little had been eaten, so plainly the lion had been interrupted by the arrival of the elephants. When he returned, the elephants still blocked our way. We could not drive round them, so we decided to make a dash for it, and drove both cars past them successfully. We wondered whether it might have been Elsa who had killed the water buck, but for her to tackle a beast with such formidable horns and heavier than herself, while protecting her cubs, would have been a very dangerous exercise. The day after our return to camp, we saw Elsa and her cubs on the big rock. As soon as she spotted us, she rushed down and bowled me over, while the cubs craned their heads above the high grass to see what was going on. When we got back to camp, we provided a meal for them over which they competed with such growls and snarls and spankings that we thought they must be very hungry. That evening, Elsa took up her usual position on the roof of the Land Rover, but the cubs, instead of romping about, flung themselves on the ground and never stirred. As it was the hour at which they were usually most energetic, we were surprised. During the night, I heard Elsa talking to them in a low moan and also heard suckling noises. They must indeed have been hungry to need to be suckled after consuming 2 goats in 24 hours. In the morning, they had gone. We followed their spoor, and it led straight to the waterbuck kill. So it must have been Elsa who 2 days earlier, after a long stalk, had tackled this formidable beast. It was hard luck on her that the arrival of the elephants had prevented her and the cubs from having a good meal. Now we understood why they had all been so hungry and so exhausted when they came into the camp. We collected the fine horns of the waterbuck and hung them in the studio, a proud record of the cubs' first big hunt with their mother. They were now 5.5 months old. When we next returned to Isiolo, we found that in a short time it was going to be necessary for George to go to the north for a 3-week safari. We did not wish to desert Elsa for so long, and as in the absence of George and his Land Rover, I should not be left with enough transport to go backwards and forwards between Isiolo and the camp, I decided that I would spend these 3 weeks in the bush, even if it upset the cubs' wildlife. Before setting off, I had 2 weeks by myself at Isiolo, after which I planned to meet George in the first week of July at the camp. He would then be returning from patrol and on his way to Isiolo to get ready for the safari to the north. As I approached the camp, I was worried because I did not see George, and drove on filled with foreboding, which was increased when, as I drew nearer, the air became so full of smoke that my lungs were stinging. When we arrived, I could hardly believe my eyes. The thorn bushes were in ashes, and smouldering tree trunks added to the grilling heat. The 2 acacia trees, which provided shade and were the home of many birds, were scorched. In the charred and blackened scene, the green canvas of the tents stood out in sharp contrast. I was much relieved when I found George inside one of them eating his lunch. He had plenty to tell me. When he had arrived, 2 days earlier, he had found the camp burning and seen the footprints of 12 poachers. Not only had they set fire to the trees and the thorn enclosure, but they had also destroyed everything they could find. They had even uprooted the little vegetable garden that Ibrahim had planted. George had been very worried about Elsa, and had fired several thunder flashes between 7 and 10 p.m., without getting any response. Then at 11, she and the cubs had suddenly appeared all ravenously hungry. Within 2 hours, they had eaten an entire goat. Elsa had been most affectionate and had several times come to lie on George's bed during the night. He noticed that she had several wounds. She left at dawn. Soon afterwards, he followed her spoor and eventually saw her sitting on Woofing Rock. Then he went off to try and discover where she had come from on the previous evening. Her spoor, which led down from the river, was mixed up with the footprints of the poachers. He wondered whether they had been hunting Elsa and the cubs. He then sent 3 game scouts to search for the camp burners. They returned with 6 of the culprits. He kept them busy rebuilding the camp, which was no agreeable task, considering the amount of thorny bush which they were obliged to cut for our enclosures. After dinner, George had to start back for Isiolo to prepare for his 3-week safari. I was not very happy to see him go at this late hour when all the wild animals were on the move. One morning, Makedi observed vultures circling, and going to the spot about a mile downstream, found the remains of a rhino which had been killed by poisoned arrows the day before while drinking. The poachers had left plenty of footprints and had erected spear traps on trees close to the drinking place. For 3 days, Elsa arrived in camp long after dark, and on the 4th brought only 2 cubs. Jesper was missing. I was very worried, so after waiting for some time, I kept repeating his name over and over again, till Elsa decided to go upstream and look for him, taking the 2 cubs with her. For over an hour, I heard her calling, till the sound gradually receded into the distance. Then suddenly there were savage lion growls, accompanied by the terrified shrieks of baboons. As it was dark, I could not go to see what was happening, and awaited the outcome feeling miserable, for I was sure that Elsa was being attacked by lions. She came back after a while, her head and shoulders covered with bleeding scratches, and the root of her ear bitten through. There was a gap in the flesh, into which one could stick 2 fingers. This was much the worst injury she had ever suffered. Little Elsa and Gopa came back with her and sat a short distance away looking very frightened. I tried to put sulfanilamide into Elsa's wounds, but she was far too irritable to let me come near her, nor was she interested in the meat which I brought her. I placed the carcass halfway between myself and the cubs. They pounced on it, dragging it into the dark, and I soon heard them tearing at it. I sat a long time with Elsa. She held her head on one side, and the blood dripped from her wound. Eventually she rose, called the cubs, and waded across the river. I could hardly wait till it was light to go and look for Jesper. Next morning, following Elsa's spoor, Makede, Nuru, and I went to the cave rock, and were much relieved to find the family reunited. I was happy to know that Jesper was safe, and that I could now concentrate on treating his mother. The wound in her ear was still bleeding profusely, and at intervals she shook her head to drain the cavity. Owing to its position, she could not lick the wound, but scratched constantly to keep off the flies. None of this was likely to improve the cleanliness of the wounds. All the cubs seemed very subdued, though Jesper licked his mother affectionately. The boys stayed out of sight while I tried to put M&B medication into the injury, but Elsa was not cooperative, and each time I approached her head, she moved away, apparently with considerable effort. Suddenly, I was startled to hear voices. I thought they were probably those of poachers. I had to think quickly. Was it best to stay put? Probably not, for Elsa did not seem to want our company, and might well go off with the cubs and fall into the poachers' hands. I went back to camp, hoping that as she must be hungry, she would follow. We made a detour on our return journey, so as to inspect the previous night's battlefield. We found it on a sandbank in the middle of the river, about 0.5 mile from the camp. There were plenty of lion pug marks mixed up with baboon spoor, but though we could distinguish the imprints of 1 male lion, we could not be sure whether he had been alone or not. I waited anxiously till the late afternoon, for Elsa and her family to arrive. I then managed to introduce some M&B tablets